Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good. We hope you join us frequently in our pleasant backyard oasis for wide-ranging conversations with a diversity of people who are growing older and want to talk about it. Hi, this is Dennis Lee. Welcome to the Backyard Oasis podcast. My guest today is Thomas McLaughlin. We met while he was ordering food in a diner. He was really pondering what to order. And for some reason, keep in mind, I didn't know him, I said, I hope you make the right decision. Well, we started the gab, and I just knew that Tom would be a wonderful guest for our podcast. Tom, nice to see you today. I know it's not a diner, but it's nice to run into you.
You've given me a lot to live up to. I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. But I'm really glad you're here today. I know you graduated from UMass in 1966 and Andover Theological School in 1970. Now, I think it's really interesting to figure out how you decided to join the clergy. Tell us about that.
Well, it was pretty simple, really, because those dates might register with a lot of folks. They were kind of crucial dates, and so I had a choice to make. I could either go to Saigon or I could go to Newton Center, Massachusetts. So I thought about that for a couple of minutes, and I thought Newton Center sounded pretty good.
Well, let's talk a little bit, though, about the decision to get as a minister. Not everybody can do that for a lot of reasons. I mean, not everybody wants to be a minister. Some people wouldn't even think about it. Did it take a long time to actually say, I want to be a minister?
Yeah, but under those circumstances, you know, choices were being made at that point that, you know, maybe weren't the most rational, but they were choices that really were outgrowths of how people had spent their lives. And so, you know, for me, as a young person, my family was always oriented toward a church. I grew up in Beverly, Massachusetts, and both my parents were first generation, they were immigrants, and so I'm first generation American. And when they came to this country, one of the churches in Beverly took that on as a service sort of project. And so right from the very get-go, before I was even born, I had a connection with a church. And some of the experiences there were really good. When I got to UMass, at that point, there was a lot going on. It was really civil rights stuff and so on. And so the church had been very informative and active for me in that regard. So it was a pretty easy thing to say, well, what are my choices? And I had known several ministers personally, spent the summer in Connecticut with a minister friend of mine and so on. So I'd known ministers. I knew who they were. They knew who I was. And it seemed like a real choice. I will say, though, and this is a comment on me, is that I had a close friend who was a minister and was a chaplain at UMass. And so he wrote a recommendation for me to go to seminary. And I bet him $5 that I wouldn't get in. So I had to pay him $5 because I got in. And then later, when I was ordained, he was at the ordination, and he gave me a framed $5 bill back. And he said, this is the five that I won, but my bet at the time is you'd never finish. And he says, now you finished, so I have to pay off.
And what was that education like? What was the process? How long did it take?
Yeah.
You were a UCC minister, I believe?
That's right.
Okay.
I think you and I talked about this a little bit before, and really, my fascination was not so much the sort of public ministry and stuff and preaching and that kind of stuff, although I have done that. But my focus, and Andover Newton was the perfect place to do this, my focus was on counseling and doing pastoral counseling particularly and working a sort of a psychological level with people. And so that's what I did when I got ordained as well. I served a church in Wisconsin, and I had a connection there, and they wanted to start a counseling center. So I started the pastoral counseling center in Wisconsin. I was on the faculty at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, and that was wonderful. And in fact, you know, the tip to that story is that a friend of mine's son went to Lawrence, and so he went out for his son's graduation, and he thought he would, you know, stop in at the church and see what was happening just so he could update me. And it turns out that the counseling center that I started 45 years ago is still in operation.
Wow.
Which I was amazed by.
Wow. So. But that's quite a legacy. I mean, just to have that.
You know, I guess at this
that's something, right?
At this point, I'm looking for legacy.
Yeah. And, well, we all want to, I mean, every time we talk to people about their lives in doing Backyard Oasis podcasts, we originally started talking about transitions, how people started in one thing and then over their life, how
right.
they did something else, yep. and then in retirement. That was the original idea. Sometimes we do that, like we're doing some of that with you.
Yeah.
Sometimes we just try to find some interesting people that have a story about their
Got
life.
It.
But that, I mean, we all want to feel like when we get out of here eventually that we made a difference.
The legacy thing is really very important to people, I think. And, you know, in our conversation before, I would just say one of my most fulfilling roles, I guess, is that I was in the ministry for 7 years and then started teaching. And so I spent almost 30 years teaching in a community college. So
right.
it's great to be back here at Greenfield, because this community college is one of the 15 in Massachusetts. And probably most of our listeners know that one of the best deals that college kids can make, and I've been selling this for a while, is that at this point you can go to a community college. And that, you know, this year for the first time, it's free to go to a community college. So you can go to a community college. If you have some success there, you can transfer to almost any school you can think of anywhere. We've had students transfer to Harvard and Yale and Wellesley and Vassar and all kinds of places. And so you're sitting next to a person 2 years later. That person's got the same degree you have, but you've paid one half the cost because you went to community college for 2 years.
Huh.
That's a good deal. And the community colleges are trying to really capitalize on that, in the sense that many people who come to community colleges don't know anything about college. Nobody in their family has been before or whatever. So being at a community college is a very good way to get oriented, to learn how to study, to learn how to manage your time. And so people who transfer to four-year schools from community colleges often really go at it much better than if they had just gone as freshman students. They come in with a lot of experience and some really good training from community colleges. So
that's great.
Good thing.
How long was the training to become a minister?
Well, it depended on who you were, but because I wanted to specialize in counseling, I spent another year. So it was actually 4 more years in Newton Center. And Andover Newton had a specialty in doing pastoral counseling, because the person who was running it had been a student of Carl Jung. And, of course, Carl Jung was the originator of one of the main streams of doing therapy and so on, worked with Freud and saw through Freud a little bit. And so, you know, those of us that were there really got a good, strong orientation. We did field work and we did all kinds of things that would help us make the transition into doing counseling.
I only know one joke about counselors or psychiatrists or psychologists.
So I suppose we're going to hear that now.
No,
right?
I probably shouldn't, but
well,
I never
on.
Said I was a classy guy.
No, that's
you know what
right,
I'm saying? So,
yeah, so what's
so
the joke?
This is a podcast. They asked me to be it.
That's
to
it.
Be here. No, a guy goes into his psychologist's office and he said, doctor, everybody thinks I'm ugly. And the psychologist says, lay face down on the couch and tell me all about it. So
that's good. Yeah. That's
and
good.
The, and
that's
there's good one. There's one more which relates to a guy goes in and says, doctor, everybody dislikes me at work. He said, where do you work? He said, I'm a car mechanic. He said, get under the couch. Okay, that's enough. This is not the Gong Show, or maybe it should be. Yeah. My poor engineer's got to listen to this. You know, Alex is our engineer, and he has to sit. You know, he knows all the technical stuff, but he has to. I'm his ticket to heaven because he has to listen to me. So he can say, you know, at some point, I had to listen to Dennis Lee on a podcast, and they say, come on in.
Well, you know, I haven't known him for long, but he seems like a great audience.
He's a really good guy. He makes me sound good, and that's an effort. So thanks, Alex. Yeah. I appreciate that. You mentioned that you traveled a lot. Let's talk a little bit about you. Well, you were in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, so I'm wondering if you found a difference in people, or are people just people, or did you notice differences from, let's say, Wisconsin to Massachusetts or anywhere else?
But when you when you use the term travel a lot, I'm married to a woman who is a history major at Wellesley College, and so when you're studying history, you learn a lot of geography. So, you know, early on, the two of us did a lot of traveling. We had the adventure of buying two French cars. They were both made in France and very good cars, and traveling all around Europe and so on. So that was the basis of kind of feeling comfortable doing that kind of thing. And then, you know, I had leads in different places about what I was going to do for a living. And sometimes it just worked out in a very different way. The church in Wisconsin was looking for a director for the counseling center, and then Lawrence University was looking for some people who would work on the dean's staff there. So that combination of things meant that for the time we were there, for 3.5 years, we lived in a dorm at Lawrence, and I was working with kids at the church and so on. One of my kids, in fact, I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but I was amazed because one of my kids was a very, very creative kind of kid and so on, you know, and I got to know him pretty well. And then he left and went to college, and we sort of got out of touch. The next time I saw him, he was interviewed by Charles Gibson on the morning show, and his name is Willem Dafoe.
Oh, geez, yeah.
So he was one of my early kids that I just thought was a great human being. And, you know, people joke about this, but one of my kids actually made it to becoming Christ.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah. I think it's interesting when you talk to teachers, and I'm always talking to out and about in the community. I do some photography, and I run into athletic directors and other teachers, and I always realize how much of an influence they have on people. But as a teacher, you don't really know at the time whether or not you have made a difference. But I've had things in my life that happened to me that somebody gave me a way of doing something that changed my entire life.
Yeah.
And I don't think he realized at the time he didn't do it for that reason. He just kind of did it.
There are examples. I think of one. I don't know if we talked about it, but there was a young couple out there in Wisconsin who wanted me to officiate at their wedding service. And that's something I always use those terms carefully because people introduce me and say, oh, this guy married my daughter. And I say, no, I didn't marry her. I just did the wedding, you know. But anyway, I did this wedding service, and they were a great couple. But I sensed that there were some issues there, and I really tried to be careful about, you know, helping them to understand it and so on. I did his funeral 6 months later.
Oh, no.
And he was a suicide victim.
Oh, no.
And, so those kind of things don't just fly by, you know. And another instance that I often think about is I had a student who was new to me. I had no idea who she was, but she was sitting in a classroom, and we were, it was a gerontology class. We were talking about elderly people. And the issue came up about nursing homes and how nursing homes sometimes hire people who are very caring people, but later they confess that they're gay or they're this or that something. And she really sounded off in class about, oh, my gosh, don't tell me those people are working in nursing homes and so on and so forth. I couldn't just let that go by. I could see that some people in the class were really kind of disturbed by that. So I gave her an assignment after class. I said, I'd like you to do a little brief research paper for me on homophobia. She came in next week and said, I never heard the word before, And I think it's important to be understanding, and so I will apologize to the class and so on and so forth. Several years later, I ran across a student. She was married to a woman, and she had been to seminary.
Wow.
So you know, you never know.
But you made a difference. I mean, you didn't think of it that when you went to work that day in the class, you didn't know that was going to happen.
That's right.
And you just reacted to what you heard.
Correct. And the difference was something that she made, obviously. She confronted herself, and that's the hardest thing anybody does, seems to me.
That's a great story. See, this is interesting because when we were sitting at the diner and we started talking, I knew after talking to you for 5 minutes, you were going to be interesting. And we ended up at the diner. We both had eaten at that point. We were there for a good hour. It took us about 20 minutes to eat, and the rest of the time we just kept talking. And I knew you had some stories. I didn't know even the few that you've given today. I didn't realize those stories, but those are wonderful.
That's a theme that I think has been with me for most of my life, and it's a theme right now that has some real push to it, because it seems to me that a lot of what's going on right now is that people have made a decision that relating to other people is just too hard. I want to be with my own tribe. I don't want to get into any arguments.
Yep.
I don't want to see things very differently from other people and so on. And to me, that is a very big, tragic situation that I think needs to be encountered, because I don't think that the human species has done much of anything that just was related to one person. I think when we do stuff, it's because groups of us get together and have an idea about what should be done and learn how to cooperate and learn how to get it done. And those are the things that get done in history. Right. They're not individual things. They're things that we do for each other, with each other, as people who care about each other. And that's a tough assignment, but it's a very crucial, critical assignment. When I was in the classroom, and this probably teachers that are listening to this might be kind of horrified, but I always thought my role was to enable students to talk to each other. I didn't think that I had, you know, the last word or any great wisdom or anything like that. I would get discussions going, but particularly when you're teaching you're teaching gerontology, there's some people there who are in their 20s, and there's some people there who are in their 40s or 50s. If you can get those people talking to each other, you can get those people learning in that classroom what that process is like and how fulfilling it is, then it seems to me you've really done something quite good.
I heard somebody say last week, I can't remember who it was, but that we're all into our own areas. In other words, now it's politics, but I guess that's the best example, but without talking specifics about the politics. But we go to, let's say, YouTube, and we go to people that are expressing our point of view. We're not listening to somebody else. And so we don't have a commonality that and they mentioned, and I thought this was interesting, one of the few times people have some commonality, he used the example of the Super Bowl, or when the Red Sox are in the playoffs. I live in a condo, you go by, everybody has got that on, and you can say to your neighbor who you don't even know, hey, boy, that was a great base hit.
That's
commonality. But if we don't do that, and somebody goes to YouTube and they watch somebody way on the right, and the other person goes to somebody way on the left, we're not talking. We're just going into our own echo chamber.
Precisely. And, you know, if you consider that the only time we've done very worthwhile things has been when we worked together, then that whole phenomenon is really something we need to address.
Wow.
We need to address it in no uncertain terms. And we're not doing it.
Right. It's a tough subject, I think. It's a tough time. I'm wondering, I started before, and I don't think we got to it. I'm curious about difference in people. I asked before, like, is there a difference in people from different parts of the country, from Wisconsin to New England? Do you notice big differences, or are they very subtle differences?
Well, I think they're subtle, and also I think I have not really in my life focused, and I don't think you have either, on the differences. What I've focused on is the similarities. And particularly when you get a group of people, it seems to me that the similarities are always there and the differences are always there. So addressing those differences and staying together to get something done or to care about each other or whatever, that's the assignment right there.
Yeah.
So, sure, I think there are regional differences. I think that we hear a lot about that in terms of pollsters and so on, finding out what people's attitudes are. People on the coasts, people with college education as opposed to people without college education. But I think it's unfortunate to really focus on those differences to some degree. I mean, it's important to understand them.
Right.
But to focus on them doesn't get us where we need to go, I don't think. I was listening to Yuval Harari this morning. He's one of my favorite philosophers and so on, you know, and he was talking about the fact that this day and age really does present issues that we have never really dealt with before. They're existential issues. If we don't come to terms with this in small ways and larger ways, we have threats at this point from the environment and from warfare and so on and so forth that could be existential threats for the species. And I think he's absolutely right about that.
Right.
I mean, we have to find ways to, if not cooperate, at least allow each other to be who we are and not say that because you don't see this the same way I do or that the same way I do, that you don't have a right to exist.
But the question is how, right?
We
can define the problem,
yeah.
But the question is how do we get there?
And I don't think that's a mystery either. I think we know how to get together. I think we know how to cooperate. We know that you have to, you know, be patient sometimes. You just have to listen sometimes. And you have to not talk sometimes. And you have to allow the other person to be who they are.
Interesting. I want to talk about some of your other experiences. You participated in the Selma, Alabama March. So you got to tell us what that was like. I mean, that's
yeah.
historic.
It seems like another lifetime, though. It seems, but some of the issues, you know, I just got a book by about John Lewis. There's been a lot of attention being paid to John Lewis. He was there with us, of course. And I guess the story, I mean, my historical story is that there were three of us from UMass that went down there. And as we drove further south, we found that it was more difficult for us to get somebody to wait on us, to pump gas, to do whatever. You know, there was some alienation there because there we were in a red Renault with Massachusetts license plates on it, you know, headed
even
south.
Even then, right?
Even then.
Yeah, right.
So it was an adventure getting there. And when we got there, we were in front of Brown's Church. Probably everybody knows where that is. It's very iconic because that's where Martin Luther King Jr. gave some of his most notable speeches and so on. But we parked the car in front of that church, and we got out, and this very tall, very black guy came, and his eyes were very wide. And he said, "You got to take that light out." And I said, "What light are you talking about?" He said, "That light that comes on in the dome of the car when you open the door, that light comes on, that's when they shoot you."
Wow.
I thought, that's a pretty good welcome. That's a good warning.
How old were you, by the way, at the time?
I was 20. And that's a good question because I thought to myself, I'm 20 years old. I'd like to live a little longer than this. And people were sacrificing their lives there. We got to know Viola Luizzo, who brought her Volkswagen van down there, and she was taking people around after dark and so on and so forth. She was shot to death 2 weeks after we left. And James Reeb had been killed. So people were giving their lives. And I said, well, I'm 20. And then I thought to myself, well, what the hell did I think I was getting myself into here? I mean, this is life and death.
Right. How did that change you? Or did it change you?
It did. I think it's a theme that I will say, I think I've tried to operate on that for a while. You know, I've tried to be careful in choices I make and so on. It affected me in another way, too, though, because many people know that, including people in my family. So if I was being outrageous or something like that, you know, more than once, a brother or a sister or somebody close to me has said, "Hey, are you the same guy that went to Selma?
Wow.
You know, and that always stops me short because I have to say, yeah, I am that person, but I'm not acting that way right now.
Interesting. Interesting stuff. I want to talk a little bit about what's happening or what did happen with regard to you teaching at North Shore Community College. You were there for 28 years in the gerontology program. I know that was a big part about what you did there, or being in that program, I should say. Tell us a little bit about what you did there and how you got into gerontology.
Good. I don't know if you've looked around lately, but if you go to churches, there's a lot of folks that are older people, you know, and so gerontology is something that's good to know about. And so I had done some reading about that. I also was interested. It was right at the time when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was doing a lot of writing, and she happened to be a Midwesterner, so I met her a couple times. She invited us to come down to her farm there.
Explain who she is quickly.
She was the one who wrote On Death and Dying, and she became the expert, and she had a tough time. She was a psychiatrist. She had a tough time with her professional career because she'd go into a hospital to talk to the dying patients, and she'd ask this one and that one, and they'd say, oh, they're all getting better, you know. So she finally figured out a good strategy. She would look for the person that was mopping the floors, and she'd say, I'd like to talk to somebody who's going through the dying process. Room 302, room 341, they knew what was going on in the hospital, and they were willing to talk about it. But some of the folks that were professional there did not know. So that was kind of revealing to her and revealing to everybody. It became, you know, a phobia people had, didn't want to talk about it. So she broke through that, and that was interesting to me. And for 28 years, every spring, I taught the death and dying course at North Shore Community College. And it was wonderful because people would relate in various ways to each other and to me that another topic would not cause as much conversation and so on, you know. So that was great. The other thing that happened was that I got a call one day, and I think I may have mentioned this to you, that I had been sort of active nationally because they were looking for community college program directors and so on in gerontology. The call was from a guy named Tony Lenzer, who was the head of the gerontology program at the University of Hawaii. And at first I thought, well, my dean was Hawaiian, and I thought, well, this is a mistake. I shouldn't be talking to you. But then he said, I'm the director here, and we just won a grant, and we'd like you to participate in the advisory committee for a program that we're doing for PBS, a series. We just won the grant to do this, and it's going to be 14 episodes. And he said, you'll have to take some time because you're going to have to travel back and forth to Hawaii a few times.
Wow.
I said, Tony, how many seconds do I have to think about this?
Right.
So I did become a member of this four-person advisory committee. We produced the series. It was on PBS, very successful. It's called Growing Old in a New Age, and it's still available.
Right. Let me ask a little bit about, or maybe we can help some people. If somebody's listening today and dealing with aging issues for themselves or a loved one, how about some do's and don'ts or maybe misconceptions about aging?
Good. I have a very simple answer to that because it's a very complicated question. So it's going to take some time and some energy. But I think the first thing to do is to find out where the local Council on Aging is, where the senior center is, because in every community in the country, there is a person and there's a senior center. And those are, you know, they're underrated, very, very helpful locations because they have to deal with what's going on in their own community. It's not a matter of theory. They're seeing elderly people every day who need services and have issues that are coming up and so on. So, you know, there's a little group of people at every senior center who have, over the years, gotten some expertise and some education and are great resources. And as I said, you know, I think my problem with it is that they're underutilized. I mean, people really should call. And they know the doctors, they know the psychiatrists, they know the home health people, and they can make good referrals, and they can help by understanding what's going on in a situation.
Wow. It's a huge topic,
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
The other thing I guess I would say is that you have to consider that it's sort of, I mean, I mentioned before, people use the death and dying course for conversations that they should have had earlier or that they would like to have had earlier. So I think the first question is, okay, what baggage am I coming into this with? And how can I deal with myself in terms of my own aging and my own issues around this? You have to let go of some of those defenses because we all get into it, you know. I turned 80 last year, and this year I turned 79. I don't know if that's really how it's supposed to go, but...
Well, so obviously you've taken some of your own advice or what you learned, right?
Obviously my own advice is something I should take more of. That's right.
Listen, probably this has been wonderful. I'm so glad I ran into you at the diner. If I didn't go in there that day, I wouldn't know you. You'd just be another guy in the community. And this has been wonderful. Thanks, Tom, and thanks for being with us on Backyard Oasis.
Thanks very much for the invitation. It's been great.
This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.